Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
All right. Well, we get into why everyone loves the Super Bowl and hates the Oscars. It's an interesting formula. I'll give you a lot of numbers. You'll be surprised on just how popular and unpopular each one is. And long form with the superstar comedian Russell Peters do that. That's coming up in a second. First, LifeLock, Predator, the Thief, Malware. It's back. It can steal usernames, passwords, browser data, and cryptocurrency. Taking photos with the infected victim's webcam. It's important to understand how cybercrime is affecting our lives. Identity theft is a serious issue. Someone's identity is stolen every 2 seconds. You could miss identity threats if you're only monitoring your credit. Good thing there's LifeLock, which detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. It's 2020. Let's protect ourselves. You're online, you're shopping, it's so convenient. Everything is done over the computer, but let's protect ourselves. Let's get a little insurance. Let's get LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year. Call 1-800-LifeLock or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam. That's promo code Adam at LifeLock.com for up to 25% off. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Russell Peters. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and Dave Damashek is here for good sports. And now, funky doghead bitch, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for sharing. We love that about you, right? KG veteran, 5 years in, Gina Grad.
That's right. Thank you.
Congratulations to you. Thank you. Bald Brian.
Here's a place where entertainers go to die.
Speaking of
going to die, I don't know if you guys are with me. In this concept, people are having a lot of difficulty with information. I feel like now they have difficulty answering questions or dispensing things.
Ironically, so we have no more information at our fingertips in our lives.
I know, but it's like it's fucking us up. And I'll tell
paralysis by analysis.
Yes, and I'll tell you one thing. I'll give you just a brief example, and then had a sort of bizarre situation happen. So. If you become a regular at the Comedy Store, you phone in on Monday and you give your avails for the week. So in a couple weeks when I go to Cleveland and Indianapolis, I will not be available on those nights that I'm there. But then if I come back Sunday, I would be available Sunday. So everyone calls in and gives their avails. But that's Monday. But then the question comes, what about Monday itself? What about that night, Monday? And they go, well, that night...
They got to get back to you quick.
It's called potluck night. And also, if you think about life and you sort of look at it logically, which I did not do, the truth shall sort of become clear, as I've always say, like regardless of what people are telling you. So, so Monday night's potluck night. And you go, well, what's potluck night? And I go,
a hot dish.
All those people.
Bring the ambrosia salad.
You come out, by the way, first it was 8:30, then it was 9:30. They can't figure out the time. But you come out at like 9:30. You put your name on a little slip, throw it in the pot, and they pull it out, and whomever does that order.
Okay.
Now, I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, what if 10 or 12 or 14 people show up? And
they're really banking on a certain number showing up.
Right. Specific number.
But also, they want you to put the name in the pot at like 9:30, and then at 9:45, they pull out of the thing. But I started thinking, well, wait a minute. What are the chances that, I don't know, Joe Rogan's going to hang around for 2 hours because he's number 13
Hope
or something like
called.
That? Yeah, That feels like open mic to me. Yeah. But
speaking of open, the open market can settle this because if Adam Carolla is there for an hour and a half to go at 9:30 spot, and he's like, "Hey, young comedian, here's $150. Let me go in your ticket number two."
No, not young comedian.
It's okay, these have all been passed.
All the past comedians.
He's like the house comic.
But it's still
you
not.
You should still say that to somebody.
It's not.
Hey, Mike Merritt, hey, Bob, see what happens.
It feels weird that Whitney Cummings sit around for 2 hours waiting to do a short spot. So it's just like, I could never. First, they said show up at 8:30, then it was show up at 9:30, then it's put in the pot. And I couldn't figure out really how did this work, but I just said, fuck it, because no one can clearly express it. Mm-hmm. I just went.
Yeah, you're smart.
Drove down there.
It's probably simpler in person than they're trying to explain it. That's my guess.
I would argue certain ideas could be conveyed over the phone. So I show up, and they're doing the Ding Dong Show there, and Scary Perry's there, and all the guys, Cousin Sal, I see there's the whole production. I didn't even know what was going on in other rooms. But either way, there's stuff going on. There's familiar faces. Danny Two Sheets is there. And at some point, I strike up a conversation with what I think is a civilian. There's comedians you recognize, mm-hmm. and then there's comedians you don't recognize, and then there's civilians. And you're not sure the difference between the civilian and the comedian you don't recognize. Right. But people hang around in the back.
Please let it be someone who's been on the show before.
Yes. So some people smoke cigarettes back there. Some people just stand out in the sort of back parking lot area. And so a guy came up to me, a bearded 40-year-old guy, and he said, I'm a big Loveline fan and blah, 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 and started talking to me. And he seemed to know his way around. So I said, this potluck thing, hey, what do you know? How does it work? And he goes, well, the Monday night, the potluck night, that's the night for all the comedians that don't get up during the week.
Oh.
It's a crucial small bit of information that could have been conveyed.
It could have been expressed.
That is a very important detail.
It could have been expressed for a number of reasons. A, if I was up multiple times that week, I seem like a douchebag showing up for the guys who don't get up tonight.
Yeah.
Now when you hear it, you go, oh, that's an explanation.
Totally
because the A-list guys aren't going to wait around for 2 hours to get a spot.
Just to see what happens.
And there should be a spot carved out for the folks who didn't make the rotation during the course of the week. And now it all makes sense, which would have kept me at home, by the way.
Indeed.
But it never been expressed. And to be fair to them, Matt never asked. It just never was described really what it was. Now we know what it was.
Well,
what it is.
Because what do you do? Because now you can't really stay because you do kind of look like a jerk.
I've been there
off
for an hour at this point. and I'm like,
trying to take some young up-and-comer spot.
And also, like, it's told, like, get there at 9:30. You don't need to get there at 9:30. You just have to put they pull the stuff out at 10.
Right.
You know, they put the thing. Anyway. So then I say, okay, and how much time? And he's like, 6 minutes or something like that. Some really short period of time, which is another piece of information that I could have used to save myself a trip from La Cañada that night.
Sure.
You know?
Question for you. Is that their de facto open mic night, or is that four comedians who've been passed?
It's four comedians who have been passed who didn't get up
on the schedule
that week, which you would probably think of not a coincidence.
The JV squad.
I don't know what we're calling them, but they didn't get up that week.
Okay.
So now I'm crashing their one night. So now I'm just sitting there, and now it's like the guys tell me about 6 minutes. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, more info. So then I think I'm talking to just a dude who's hanging around the back who seems to know the lay of the land. And then at some point, I head into the original room and I sit down and I see this guy pick up the microphone. And he's doing crowd work, but he's doing crowd work where he's like calling this chick a skank and she just gets up and leaves and blah, blah, blah.
Jesus.
And I've never seen, there's a light on the side that they light you up with 2 minutes ago. The person is on, like, he's on that switch like he's playing whack-a-mole.
It's like a strobe light.
Yeah, it's like
people are having seizures, epileptic fits.
It's about 10 minutes in, and the guy's like just going at it, and this
That's
guy's
amazing.
Going, hey, skank, where are you from, skank? And I'm like, oh my God, this is the person I was just talking to. He's not doing an act. He's just up there.
Abusing the crowd.
Abusing the crowd.
Big Loveline fan.
And these guys are supposed to be doing 3 minutes, and he's going to make a minute 12, and they're like
going nuts on him. Like, I just got information from a lunatic.
He's an insane person.
He's up on stage. Like, literally, the MC came out and just went, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry for what just happened. Like, literally, I was like, I stood out there talking to the guy on the patio for half an hour.
What goes on at this asylum? The patient's like, well.
It's not often that the MC comes back and basically goes, I'm sorry for what you'd witnessed. I was sort of amused by it because it seemed insane, and also I realized I was talking to this serial killer moments earlier.
He was like Tommy. He was like Tommy DeVito from Goodfellas. You know, Joe Pesci's character. Once you're made, once you're in, you know what I mean. You can do whatever you want.
No. Now. Sorry, not made. 3 minute. Friends and family from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Okay. Then the potluck.
So actually,
starts.
He's even more like Tommy because Tommy wasn't made. Tommy just would do whatever he wants, thinking someday I'll just be in.
Right.
Way to make that point work, Brian.
That's where I was going with
that. They do the 3 minute, folks who work the door kind of up and coming, whatever, from 7 to 10, and then at 10, that's when the potluck starts.
Gotcha.
So Jimmy Conway comes in.
I'm just sitting giving there.
That 20s for keeping the ice cold.
I just go, what the hell is going on?
So what was his deal?
I don't know.
He just disappeared into the mist?
He did. And but he did.
He ever there?
He did seem to have a lot of information.
Was it accurate? Did that come to be?
The 6 minute wasn't. It was more like 10 minutes. But it was pretty accurate. Yeah. So it was a weird night. But it also kind of made me think. You really only learn things by physically showing up and sort of walking around. Like, I was just walking up to the belly room, walking to the main room, walking to the ridge room, like just seeing people walking around. Like, at some point, everyone is doing like, I can do it from my home, from my phone, or whatever it is they think they can do. At some point, you got to get a little boots on the ground.
You got to
just, if it's even it's a relationship with the guys moving the cars out there, he's got to know who you are. He's got to know who your car is, who that guy is, like what you are.
Yeah. You got to get the lay of the land.
Had to want to know about me tuning piano. That was an insane conversation.
Well, that's on you.
That is
the other young comedian looks at you like, you really are struggling.
So
against me,
there was that. Then I had this thought, one interesting, one important. I had to get up early and get out yesterday, and I broke my pool plunge promise.
Oh,
I got up and I got out. Now,
puss.
I had something to do that was specific and sweaty and early and blah, blah, blah. And I just said, I'll get into it when I get into it at some point today. Then when I return from work, I see Sonny. And Sonny's got the towel over his shoulder and he's making his way toward the pool. And I said, wait a minute.
Oh,
we had a deal.
Heated.
Your deal was Tuesdays and Saturdays. Your deal was 2 days a week. This is an off day for you, in other words. What gives with you? And he gave the best answer that a parent could ever hear. And I'm curious what you guys do in this regard and what everyone does in this regard.
Was he banking one?
No. Oh. He said, I like that, but this is better. He said, I was shooting hoops. On the back patio there, I made myself a deal. I had to make 7 out of 10 three-pointers, and I didn't make it.
70%?
He shoots a lot of threes.
Wow.
He made the deal with himself, lost, and now he's going to flog himself.
And had he not, no one would have been the wiser.
Right.
Unbelievable.
I then said, well, your timing's impeccable because this is the one time I didn't hit it in the morning and I'm hitting it now.
Wow.
So we'll go with Father-Son team. But he imposed that on himself. And I thought, that's what we want.
He has more character than everyone I know combined.
That's good. At a younger age.
Yeah. Oh,
now,
easy.
I'm curious because everyone, I hope, plays little games with themselves.
Oh, yeah.
On my rowing machine. It's on the, I don't know how it works, but there's some asswipe who calls himself Ace Man, and he's always on there, and he's always like two spots in front of me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this guy's trolling me. There's a guy named Ace Man.
The rowing's come from inside the house.
And I got to catch him.
Yeah, you got to catch you.
Because he's using my my handle. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what my handle is. My handle just says you. I don't know what it is.
What if it was you?
I don't know what it is.
It's very Fight Club. Let's look at the tape.
I know what it is. But I find myself like I'm at 4,200 meters and this and 86 meters. This guy's at 4,311. And I'm like, I'm catching myself. I'm catching the Ace Man. I don't know if the guy's trolling. I don't know where the Ace Man comes from. But I see it on my screen frequently. And I want to catch him. It's a little game. When I used to skip a lot of rope, I'd have like a little thing where I had to go, you know, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4. And I screwed up, I'd start again, right. You know, and I'd keep going to whatever. Sonny's screwing with himself to try to get himself better at something.
Accountable.
Do you guys have
a shooting hoop? You know what I mean?
Right. Just do you have a version of that? And who doesn't have any version of that? And it's that same person who has no versions of that. Is that the same? No New Year's rezo person, because I think they may hang out in
the same
hut.
Person.
Yes.
I'm sorry, mine was, ironically, the rowing machine. I forget what the actual incrementals were, but I had to get, I think it was 500 meters per every 5 minutes, so I had to do 2,020 minutes, or whatever it was. I remember it was the same. Yes. It was the same. It was like, I had to get 500 this 5 minutes and 500 that 5 minutes.
If you go for half an hour and you go at a decent clip, you'll get to 6,000 meters.
Go. And so it's probably 10, whatever it was. It was some snap.
And so I do that too with 85 seconds left and I'm off by 250 meters.
You got a whole
it's
ass.
Like I want to get to that
cranking.
Six. Yeah. Which is good, but it's not totally self-imposed in that it's a number, it's a digit. It's like in front of you, you get sucked into it. You know what I mean? Like I get sucked into it. It's not an invisible self-imposed, you know what I mean?
A
conversation in your head. You guys have versions of that.
It's funny. This might make me the laziest sadist ever because I can't think of an example where I do that for myself, but I do that to the kid constantly. So I don't know if maybe I should take a look in the mirror, but we're trying to get him to memorize our phone numbers in case, you know, he, God forbid, ever got lost or something. So he hits that number wrong, we'd start it over, he hates it. But things like that, it's easy to do for other people, but I can't think of an example of doing it for myself.
Well, it's a good, you know, it's interesting because we're in an era where we're talking about, you know, Lizzo. We're not in Thin Lizzy. No, that was a better time.
Thick Lizzo?
That was a little rock and roll. There's a new band in town, kids. It's called Thick Lizzo. Thin Lizzy.
Tonight, we're going to see some buttons ring.
Hey, you, good-looking female. Hey, it's a jailbreak. Some buttons break.
That water was almost everywhere. Oh, my God.
I need that validation.
Right. The taco truck's back in town. Taco truck's back in town. Bam, bam. It's got the soft swirl ice cream in the back. Bam. Yeah, Thick Lizzo. The Thick Lizzo era is everyone accept yourself because you're perfect the way you are and you're beautiful.
That's
and you love
rule.
Yourself and everyone loves yourself.
You'll
and,
be cool.
Yeah. And you, everyone has to accept themselves for who they are. They have to love themselves. They have to realize that they are unique and unlike nobody else and that nobody can judge them and they can't judge themselves. And it does fly in the face of you torturing yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
the exact opposite.
Right. But unfortunately, for a good society and a successful life, the I'm 121 pounds overweight, I love myself, versus I'm going to throw myself in a freezing pool if I don't make imaginary baskets, is a better wiring for later success.
Gina, you've had lots and lots and lots and lots of therapy. You understand that, problem is that we're don't beat yourself up over things that aren't worth beating yourself for no reason.
Right.
You know, aren't worth beating yourself up for. But if there's something that's inefficient in your life, beat yourself up a little bit over it.
Yeah, it's inefficient to just sit there and sulk about it, but you do need to correct it and move forward.
Right. All right. Other thoughts. I was happy to hear that. Other thought was I was talking to Dr. Drew earlier, and we were talking about he had not liked Parasite, or at least the message. Or he says he liked it, but now he changes his tune all the time.
Now there's Best Picture. He's all in.
Yeah. He said, "What do you think of the Oscars?" I said, "It's all right. It's getting a little woke now." And also, as I've said,
when I was younger and I watched the Oscars, it was big stars and big films, and now it's getting very boutique-y and super woke and a little preachy and stuff like that. And I've always said, why do people love sports? I mean, why do they love it on a visceral level? Because our feelings about sports are not a passing sort of pleasure. I'm trying to think. It's like, you know, when people go, you know, we're not meant to eat meat. Our digestive system and our teeth. And it's like, how come when I pass a barbecue place, I get fucking wood?
Yeah.
Like, why do I start salivating and get tumescent? If I'm not meant
your
to.
Your wood starts salivating.
I'm not meant. You can't.
You should get that looked at.
This is not something that you can't train me to be this way. I have if you go to Adam Perry Lang is over at Kimmel's house and he's got some, porterhouses, 2-inch thick porterhouses on the grill. You walk past it and you literally start having a physical reaction to it. I said, okay. So with sports, we have like a reaction to it that's deep, man. I mean, look at Kobe Bryant's death. You know what I mean? That's the reaction to that guy's not the reaction you have to an actor or of another entertainer or whatever.
True.
That's a strong visceral reaction. Strong. Okay, ask Snoop Dogg. What would Snoop Dogg have to say about that again? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right. Anyway. I'll let you find it. The point is this.
Funky dog head, bitch.
Yeah. Now, again, when an actor dies, you don't have that reaction. So, now what is it? Okay, it's a purity. It's a purity. In a world where it's all about who's your daddy and who you know, and you know, it's constant claims. By the way, this guy was born on third base, thought he hit a triple. Or this guy comes from privilege or white privilege, or sure he was destined for this because he comes from this neighborhood, or he doesn't come from the wrong side of the tracks. Every single one of those people on the field comes from possibly the wrong side of the tracks. Mm-hmm. None of their dads own the team, own the stadium, or in upper management or anything. They're mostly African Americans, but there's one white dude, you know, Joey Bosa. That guy kicks ass, you know, because he kicks ass. No one's going,
They just
put him in there because there are too many black guys on the defense, and they wanted a white guy on the defense because otherwise he would have been all. No. He kicks ass. He's out there. And if there were 11 of him that kicked ass, and they'd be out on the field. Spike Lee wouldn't be happy, but that's how it works. And we look at it is these are the 22 best players on the field. And even if there's a sense of, isn't that backup quarterback? I think he's a little better than the guys on the field. Still, we believe the coach is making the decision based on wanting to win the game, not favoritism or he knows a distant relative or anything. So there's a purity to it, and it's super attractive to us. And the Oscars, when I grew up, had the same sort of feel to them, like the best movie and the best actor.
The purity.
And now I feel like there's some other boxes checking that are starting to, and they're polluting a little bit. And when it gets polluted a little bit, you lose a little bit of interest, just as you would if you were watching the Super Bowl and you were questioning a couple of guys on this team and a couple of guys. Is that guy really the best guy, or is he just out there because of his heritage, or because of that one guy's bi-curious, so he's starting at free safety? Right. It sounds laughable, but it would water down the game. So I looked up some stats, or I yelled at Gary to look up some stats.
I was going to say, please be clear.
This year, the Super Bowl was watched by over 45% of the country, which is getting near half. And the Oscars were watched by 7% of the country. And I thought, what was it like some years ago? Not, I need percentage with Gary because
early 70s,
can't do numbers because smaller group. Right. But in 1975, 22% of the country watched the Oscars and 33% watched the Super Bowl, which is not as big a chasm.
Not at all.
It's still more Super Bowl, but since 1975, and with some variations and fluctuations, the Super Bowl has been growing and the Oscars have been shrinking. And I think if you talk to most people, even if they can't put their finger on it, it's sort of what I've been talking about. Like, people are like, is that the best movie because it's the best movie, or it's just because the Oscars is trying to send this message out? And that, when that purity is gone, the audience kind of moves along with it too.
It's the same reason in sports they didn't allow any relationship gambling, any whatever, because, well, up until recently, because they didn't want, and even the image of impurity, you know what I mean?
Great. Okay, let's see. I've got Got a thing. Let me hit the Tommy John. Guys, Valentine's Day right around the corner. The only day of the year you want to get caught with your pants down. Make sure you're wearing Tommy John. Legs never ride up. Waistbands never roll down. I'm wearing my Tommy Johns right now. Midnight blue. I believe that to be the best color. Warm in the pool with Sonny, hung them out to dry, picked them up this morning.
That's the way I rock.
Fresh as a daisy down there. And what about your lady friends? Tommy John has ended the visible panty lines, plus the most comfortable bras on the planet. Limited edition Valentine's Day underwear and loungewear. Boo, that loungewear is so damn comfortable. It's like everything they do. It's just top shelf. You get 10% off. All backed by the best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Right, Dawson?
Shop limited edition Valentine's Day gift sets and get 20% off your first order when you go to TommyJohn.com/Adam. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/Adam.
All right. An interesting philosophical thought that I wanted to share with you, which was weeks ago when we were in Milwaukee, and we couldn't be a greater contrast than what we'd done, which is I'd left my house at 7:30. Mike parked at the Wally Park.
Hey, Mike, he's talking about you, you fuck ass.
Forgot his ticket later, but he parked ways away. Chris Ubered in. I parked in the top floor of the park, to wind around the LAX parking structure. Met Mike, met Chris. We got on a plane, 9 a.m., flew Coach Plus to Phoenix, got off in Phoenix, went to another plane, flew Coach Plus
to
Milwaukee, got a rental car.
You have money.
Got a rental car in Milwaukee, drove directly to the theater because we didn't have a hotel room in Milwaukee. Had like 2 hours to kill, so Mike and I took a walk around Milwaukee while Chris was prepping. Past the statue of the Fonz by the river.
Right. Are you serious?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Have a statue of the Fonz. Walked 2 blocks, saw that Seinfeld was playing the Mega Theater there. Mike is friendly with one of Seinfeld's best friends, and he's Barry Martyr's been on this show, and we're talking about doing some projects with him, and Mike has a shorthand with him, and so Mike calls up Barry, and he goes, and this is Mike and I. Now, it's snowing, we're just walking in a circle around Milwaukee, because we don't have anywhere to go other than Showtime, you know, and there's not that much to do in the bowels of the theater. And then we're going to go eat kielbasa with Cousin Sal's brother-in-law and 8 other drunk people. And then we're going to drive in a snowstorm to Chicago.
Sounds
that night.
Great.
That's our night.
Cool.
So he talks to Barry, and I think Mike's saying, hey, you know, your buddy's 2 blocks away. Want to have a beer or hang out or do whatever? And Barry's like, Seinfeld does the shows, walks right out of the theater, walks right out the back door, gets in a car, goes right to the airport, private jet, home, sleeps in his own bed. And I said, yeah, that's what Leno does.
Yeah, the Leno
he goes
booth.
right out the thing. So our first thought is always, God damn, that must be nice. Now, you got to have a limo and you got to have a private jet.
Is he going to Chicago?
Yeah. And all that money is coming out of the money you would be making when you're doing it. But he makes so much money that that's fine.
So Mike and I are walking around in a circle in the snowstorm by Fonzie's statue, and we're going, God, man. Because we know what we have awaiting us, and we know what we've been through. It started...
Hey,
we're looking at Fonzie's statue by the... Boy, did they swing and miss on this statue, because this statue is a bizarre size. It's not lawn jockey size, and it's not human being size. It's a little bit smaller than human being size, which somehow throws you. It's weird. Like, if for another, you know, bell and a half worth of bronze, they could have made a regular Fonzie statue, but they made, like, a weird Fonzie size. He's small.
Is it Henry Winkler sized?
Henry Winkler is a small guy, but if you go to this statue, you will realize it is too small in scale. It's just a little bit small.
Leto's Joker.
So, anyways, got the thumbs up. It's wearing a life jacket. Anyway, who's had the bigger transformation from, like, you in your childhood and what you're... We're looking at an average size woman, I guess, standing next. You can see that Fonzie's the wrong size,
that's
right?
That's a hip dude.
It's a guy.
The Lumineers.
Oh, it's a singer of the Lumineers.
Yeah. So it makes,
to be fair, he's got long hair and he's wearing a lot of stuff.
It makes Fonz look like maybe an eighth grader's height, like a middle school kid's
it's
height.
It's a weird size. Yes. Right? Yeah. As long as you're going big, like almost full scale, then just go full scale.
Yeah, that's weird.
Okay. Who's had a bigger... covered more ground in this sort of, like, George Foreman.
That's me already.
George Foreman or Henry Winkler. Because when I grew up, Henry Winkler was a tough guy.
Right.
And now Henry Winkler's the menschiest, softest, nebbishy Jew in the world. And George Foreman was a tough guy. And I mean, he was scarier than Tyson. He was kind of Tyson before Tyson. And now he's everyone's big grandpa.
Yeah.
The irony is, I think they went from Winkler playing the character to being himself, from Foreman being himself to playing the character.
Oh, right. Interesting.
Because I see him, you know, on TV and smile, like, my friends that invent help will get help you get. Like, yeah, I'm sure that you're close friends that invent help.
He's not going to move those grills with a puss on his face.
Close friends.
So, Mike and I are circumnavigating Milwaukee in the snow, and we're both kind of lamenting that while we're driving in a snowstorm to Chicago tonight, Seinfeld's going to be heading home sleeping in his bed.
Yeah.
And then I say to Mike, yeah, Seinfeld does it that way, and Leno does it that way, and a lot of guys do it that way. But I say, you know, think about all the experiences we've had. You know, we've been to St. Louis, I think, or Kansas City, I can't remember. We went to St. Louis and had the Z-Man sandwich. Like, we've had people go, like, you know those places? Mm-hmm. We've been to Permanthes and had the Permanthes sandwich. Right. We've done all of that stuff because we're like, hey, if we're driving from this place to that place,
we're in town.
I want to go try that Z-Man sandwich. Weird. We've been way off the beaten path with Polish joints that were, like, in people's houses with people you'll never see before, and crazy stories with road trips, with laughs, with, you know, some ups and some downs. And some trials and tribulations, but we have seen everything. We didn't see the inside of the theater, the inside of the limo, and then the inside of the private jet. We were on the road, man.
Experience life.
You say to me, what's in between Milwaukee and Chicago, or how long is the drive between Milwaukee? I'm like, I'll tell you, I've done that. I know how long it is. And it's a little bit of a mindset, but I thought, you know, we're having all these experiences and we're pulling into these towns you would never set foot in, and we're finding where all the best barbecue is, and we're going there, and we're meeting people.
Oh, we've been to Franklin's. We had the private back area.
Right.
That was awesome.
All ourselves. That was badass.
Z-Man is Kansas City.
Z-Man? What is that?
Oh, it's
Zarda?
It's the best goddamn sandwich. What is on a Z-Man? And I'm telling you,
Z-Man.
Prepare yourself for really... Like,
all right.
I gotta be honest. Can I be honest?
Please
be
honest.
Can
Please.
I be sandwich honest? Sorry, Sheck. Permanthes, no. That was a big build-up and a little bit of a swing and a miss. Fine, but a lot of build-up with Permanthes. Yeah. That's in Pittsburgh. The Z-Man.
Shut up.
Did not disappoint.
Oh, it's at Joe's. Okay.
Yeah.
It's all coming together.
Oklahoma Joe's.
Yep.
So it stacks slow-smoked brisket on top of a butter-toasted Kaiser roll with smoked provolone, two onion rings, and barbecue sauce.
All right.
I think it's the smoked provolone that puts it over the top, but goddamn, that Z-Man sandwich.
She's like,
and just the fact this place is a strip mall.
Yep.
Looked like it was a gas station or something. I mean, this
That's
does
right.
not seem like a barbecue joint, but that place
they do
gets
have
busy.
Essentially a gas station location.
We've been to the St. Louis one. We've been to Martin's in Nashville. I mean, we've just been to all these places. There's places like the bucket listy kind of, or if you ever did one of those stupid Visa credit card
experience.
Yeah. This is the least barbecuing place look in the world. It's like stucco, and there's a gas station
That's
attached
right.
to it, but goddamn, does it crank it out.
Do you have half chub right now?
Oh, I gotta tell
you. Just look at the picture.
But just the notion also was awesome, because we went in, ordered a bunch of shit, came back out to the car, and was like, we hit it at like 11:15, and there was like nobody there.
Oh, lucky.
And then we come back to the car, and we're like looking at him. I'm like, Mike, where's the Z-Man? And he's like, oh, we didn't. I just got some brisket and some this and that. And we're like, well, we came here for the Z-Man. And Mike went, well, then we're going to get the Z-Man. And in that period of time, 23 people just piled in.
Because
those places, like 11:30, and everyone just piles in.
Yeah, I can't imagine it without a line out the door.
And there's a line going out the door. And Mike goes, I'll get the Z-Man. I go, but Mike,
luck.
We don't got time for this. And he goes, oh, no. And he just walks right to the cash register, comes right in front of everybody, and goes, hey, we need Z-Man, like we forgot. You know, and everyone's just kind of looking at him, and I'm going, Mike, no. And he just goes right in
right
front.
Right to the front.
Gets the Z-Man, walks right out. We're eating our Z-Man on the road.
That's good.
But I thought, philosophically, now don't get me wrong, I'd still rather do what Seinfeld does. Yeah. But I thought, we've been forced to see this nation.
For sure.
And I just found out, I just said to Matt the other day, I was like, we're doing Hilarities February 27th. I said, how are we getting to Indianapolis? Like, you're driving. Like, how long is that drive? 5 hours. Like, okay. Now I'm going to tell Matt, find some barbecue place or find some Polish place in between.
Good luck Polish, yeah.
Cleveland and
Polish.
Yeah, in Indianapolis, and that's where we're going to go.
Yeah.
And we've done it everywhere. So, I don't know. Whatever you want, Paul Rudd has Z-Man sandwiches flown out to his home in New York.
That's power
That's good
move.
Stuff. He's from my Overland Park.
It's his favorite sandwich in the world.
There it
I
is.
I like that man. He's a genius. I told you I love Ant-Man. Didn't I tell you how much I love Fly
you won't
Girl?
Shut up about it.
Yeah, the Wasp and Ant-Man. Fucking love that franchise.
You know, Adam, just hearing you talk about all the places you've been, this might be a good time for either you or Rich Banks, or a combination of the two, to update the Charlene song.
You've
been to Indianapolis,
you've
been to Cleveland, but have you ever been to you?
Can somebody execute my idea? I pitched this idea 20 years ago. It's starting to slowly come around, but it's not really here yet. I call it home court advantage. It's a food court.
Oh, this is
all
good.
All the Permantes and the Z-Man.
You got to bring this back.
All the stuff you moved, you craved, you can't get. All the talk,
that's
the deep
good.
Dish pizza. Oh. You don't know how good it. And everyone's that argument. Just write down. It's all it is.
The Dutch Crunch bread from San Francisco that I can't get anyone else to agree. Dawson, Dutch Crunch? Come on, buddy.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh, so good.
Home court advantage.
Home court.
It's just a food court.
That's
it's
so
got
good.
All. Instead of the generic Chinese place,
yeah,
let's do it. Just have the best.
That's great.
Of everywhere.
The flip pizza from New York.
Yeah, except for it's all, you know, the notion of like I'm flying sandwiches in from Kansas City is like, it's good, but the sandwich is not going to be in the shape it was when Mike ran out to the rental car. All right, let's take ourselves a break. Russell Peters, international superstar, will be in next.
ACS fans, get it on. We wanted to take a moment to tell you, if you haven't signed up for the Corolla newsletter yet, you're missing out. Every Saturday, you'll get exclusive video content you can't get anywhere else, behind-the-scenes stories, and a new giveaway each and every week. We've already given out an all-expense-paid trip to L.A. to watch the Super Bowl with Ace. And this week, one lucky winner will get a signed Corolla DVD set, docs, films, and specials from Chassis, all signed by the Ace Man himself. Enter for your chance to win at CorollaNewsletter.com today. In the spirit of Murrow, Jennings, Cronkite, here's another great moment in local news.
It was supposed to be a meeting about candidates running for former Congresswoman Katie Hill's seat.
But some argue it turned into a hate crime.
That's a great moment in local news. Now, back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Russell, we hot here? Oh, sorry. Yeah, Russell Peters. There we go. In studio. It's got a stand-up special, Russell Peters Deported. It's available now on Amazon Prime Video. I've not seen it yet, but I shall watch it because I always watch Russell's stand-up specials.
I appreciate your lack of support on this one.
Oh, no. I shall be supporting just retroactively. Also doing shows in Las Vegas at the Encore Theater. In the Wynn Hotel, two shows June 6th, and tickets go on sale this Friday. Go to WynnLasVegas.com. Russell's a good guy, and there's nothing better than a regular dude. I don't mean that...
That's a good way. That's a good thing.
But there's not enough regular dudes these days,
especially,
right?
Especially in this business.
Right. Like,
there's a lot of people.
There's a lot of people, but there's not that many just dudes.
Yeah, I think that's what scares the industry.
What happened to you where you just grew up? Were you like, people say to me, like, oh, you haven't changed because of show business. And I was like, because I was locked off. I didn't have any success until I was 30, 31. I was already humbled. I was just who I was. You couldn't undo me.
I was 36 by the time it happened for me. 35, 36, yeah.
How many years of knocking around did you have?
It was 16 years at least.
You know, my general take on people, like with musicians and stuff like that, like if you've been knocking around for over 15 years and it hasn't happened, it's probably not going to happen. But there's in comedy, it's maybe a little different. I don't know.
In comedy, the longer the incubation period, the better.
Yeah.
The better you become. You don't become very, very, very seldom have you seen some comic get worse over time.
You know, I think I won't use names, but people can probably think of a few people where they threw you your own show or your own stand-up special, or they threw something at you like too fast.
Yeah.
And the person wasn't really ready for it. And then the product wasn't really that good because they weren't really ready for it. And now that's what people think of when they think of them.
Yeah. If that's their first introduction to you, that's how they view you forever. I am lucky. Like, the first introduction that they had of me was my third special, so nobody saw the first two.
Right.
So the one that they got to see was the good one, and then everybody benchmarks it against that.
Do you look back on stuff you were doing earlier in your career or even earlier in the year and kind of go, I mean, I feel like it's built into all comedians. It's sort of like when women look at old pictures of themselves, they always go, oh, what was I thinking with my hair? And I always kind of have that with jokes, too. Like, I go, I don't do it with everything, but I kind of go, oh, I wish I knew now. Oh, or I knew then what I know now.
Oh, my God. I look at my old stuff. It's horrible. Oh, right. Some of it's bad. I'm like, oh, my God. How did you think that was funny? How did you think that was a joke? How did you think that was like – that wasn't even a good premise.
Well, how does it work for you, or how did it work for you getting from – doing an impersonation of a comedian to doing Russell Peters?
I think it took me about, I would say it took me about 10, 11 years to get into my own skin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my 31st year of doing stand-up now. So after, yeah, it took me at least 10 years to start getting comfortable with myself on stage.
Who, you don't come from you're Canadian, right?
Yes, that is correct, Adam.
And your family's Indian, right?
That is also correct.
And it's not really where you come from. It's not really a place where a lot of comedians come from. It's not a hotbed of comedy.
Canada is, yeah.
Well, Canada is, yeah. But Indian. Well, but now a lot more. But,
well, now I'm the first one, right? So I'm the first Indian guy to be there doing it.
Well, you are, right?
And yeah, and I got a bunch of comedy babies, as they call them.
Right. But so what got you, what made you think this was a good idea?
I was just a fan of comedy. And I needed to say I'm doing something to make my parents happy. Like, what is your job? I'm like, I'm doing this. Even though they didn't know what it was, they were like, I don't know, he's doing something.
Did your parents, were they interested in you doing something other than comedy?
No, we're a very blue collar family. So basically any job, whether it's working in fast food or working in the mall or working in a warehouse, anything that brings you a steady paycheck is all they care about. They don't care about the amount of money on the paycheck. They just want to know that you're out there trying to make an honest living.
You know, it's interesting, the mentality, like the thrive versus stay alive. And I don't think people are aware of that. You know, everyone always talks about different cultures, or socioeconomic or blah, blah, blah. But it's like the approach to work with my family was get a job and fight to keep it. There wasn't like have a career.
Yep.
There wasn't a discussion like, what do you want to do or what are you good at? Or, you know, this bird's got to fly. You know, there was no soaring. It's like, go get a job and don't fuck it up.
Yeah, that's the regular blue-collar mentality. That's why when people are like, you know, they talk about like, oh, middle America. I go, I understand middle America fully.
Right.
Like, I would have been middle America in Canada.
Yeah, you didn't think about, you know, you didn't really think about excelling. You didn't think about passion in your work. You didn't really think about this notion of your muse or whatever. It's just like jobs suck. You have to have one.
Yep.
Find one that sucks a little less than one of the other jobs. Go get it and hang on with both hands.
Yeah. And my parents weren't making enough money to support me anyway. It's not like they were going to. My dad was like, I'm not busting my ass for you to sit around. No, that ain't going to happen. Go get a fucking job. I started working when I was like, I had a paper route at, must have been 12. Mm-hmm. Then I started working at KFC at 15. And then from there, that was it. I just kept working.
Yeah. I tell my kids all the time, I'm not really that interested in how you do at school, but you do need to know how to work.
Yeah. You need an ethic.
Yeah. And you take that ethic and you bring it right into comedy.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly how I do it. You know, I'm on the road constantly, and that's because I'm scared to stop working.
Yeah, but also you get a lot of meaning from work. I feel like there's a lot of people trying to run from work when they should sort of lean into it.
Yeah, I mean, I dig it. You know what I mean? I like to know that. It's also an ego stroke as well. You know, you get on stage, people clap, they smile, they love you. It's a wonderful thing. What's wrong with that?
No, I agree. And it's interesting how your brain is always kind of trying to normalize everything. So if you grew up in a shitty apartment in the valley and then you move into 9,000 square feet of luxury, your brain is working to make it normal.
Yeah, you know what I mean? That's constant for me.
Right. And so you don't open the door and go, oh, my God, I'm blessed. You open the door and go, the fucking mail's on the floor. Who left the mail on the fucking floor?
You know, what's funny is I do the exact same shit.
Right.
I'm exactly that guy. I'm like, who the fuck left the TV on? You're not even in that room.
Right.
Well,
right.
Why would you? What? I'm going back there. Well, turn it off and turn it back on when you get back there.
Right. So there's a constant sort of attempt to normalize no matter where you are. And then there's also part that kind of turns work into work, even if your work is going up on stage and getting paid tons of money. It's like, where do I got to be? You got to be at the whatever theater. What time? Oh, how long's the ride from the airport? Like, and you have to resist that urge, right? To turn this blessing of stand-up comedy into work and to turn your 9,000 square feet into a house.
Well, it's a constant struggle. But I think when you try to normalize work like that, it's good for me. But the people around you don't understand that that's what you're doing.
Right.
They see it as, oh, he's becoming a fucking diva.
Right.
You know what I mean? What do you need to know for? Because I just want to know.
Right.
I want to know what my day is like. What's my time? When can I sleep? When can I have me time?
How much acting are you doing?
Not that much.
How much do you want to be doing?
I wouldn't mind doing more, but whatever. You know, it's not up to me. It's up to the industry. I can go write my own thing, but listen, if I was that diligent, I'd be further in my career.
Well, let's talk about that, because I never had a lot of faith in the industry. So my feeling was, well, I'll have to create my own stuff so I can work.
Right.
You know, and early on, I had my roommate, Ralph. I remember I saw him one Saturday afternoon. He was just...
By the way, this story sounds fake already.
Stuffing. No, it was Ralph Garman from K-Rock. Ralph was my roommate. He was just stuffing envelopes with headshots and resumes. And I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm sending them out, trying to get an agent. And I was like, who's going to do that? Like, who's going to... That's going right into the garbage, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, no, people look at it. I'll get an agent. I don't think it worked. But the point is like I thought if I put a picture of myself in an envelope and send it to somebody, they'll just throw it away.
I think the exact same way. I'm like, when I remember I started in 89 and people were like, you need a headshot. I'm like, really? For what?
Right.
And then, you know, I made sense to me. Like, let me put it up at the comedy clubs. When you're coming, I go, okay, that makes sense.
Right.
And then I got an acting agent in Canada. You need a headshot. I'm like, and you need this style and that style. And they were this, you know, the ones where you have your blazer over your shoulder and
yeah.
You're showing your different looks.
Yeah, the composite. Yeah, the short order cook.
Yeah.
It
equaled zero work for me.
Right.
Literally zero.
Yeah. I think I used to go on auditions. A million years ago. It's just the only work I ever really found was work that I created for myself.
Yeah.
And I think more people should sort of adopt that, right? I mean, whatever business you're in, just sort of have this feeling of like, I got to create something.
I think more people are doing that nowadays than ever before. I mean, you know, guys are starting, you know, everybody's got a podcast now.
Right.
Although you were one of the pioneers.
Sure.
Everybody's got one now. That's everybody's way of saying, look, I'm doing something for myself. Or they're taking charge of their social media. They're getting more proactive in whatever, you know, whatever aspect they can.
Yeah. It's a weird time we're living in because you can do so much on your own. It's kind of like working weekends. Like, you can work every weekend. You can work at night. Like, as long as you got that computer on your lap, where's the cutoff? How do we define a work day
right.
anymore? And you could have 15 businesses going, and then how do you balance it? How do you figure that out? Like, what do? You go to the gym, you hit the heavy bag, do that kind of stuff. Like, where do you get your balance?
I'm doing jiu-jitsu every day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've been doing that almost 4 years now.
And what do you get out of that?
It's like boxing for me, but it's on the ground now. It hurts a lot less.
Right.
You know, different parts of you hurt now.
Right.
Like today my ankle's hurting and my thumb is hurting, but, you know.
What do you think where do you think that connection comes from so many performers doing jiu-jitsu? Like, is it a fad? Is there a connection?
No, I'm addicted to it. You know, and I'm like you. I come from a boxing background. So you get to a certain age, boxing's just not conducive to your lifestyle anymore.
Sure.
How old are you now?
55.
Yeah, so I'm 50 this year. It hurts now when you box. Listen, it hurts my hands.
First off, that's me trying to straighten my fingers out. My fingers are all jacked up. I got nodules in my palms. Like, I really can't box anymore.
Yeah,
I really couldn't hit anything.
Yeah, it changes the entire thing now.
I beat my kids a little bit, but they're soft.
I know.
You know, I couldn't hit a heavy bag anymore.
These kids, and at least they make a noise. The heavy bag doesn't.
So for you, you have this interesting you have this interesting career in that you're a huge stand-up comedian, but you can probably get by without getting – you probably walk through the airport without getting stopped every 10 feet, or at least maybe LAX. I don't know.
Nowadays, it's starting to pick up.
You do get stopped
more. I'm getting stopped more, and I'm getting stopped more by people who I would never have thought would have stopped me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding it quite interesting. I dig it. You know, I love that kind of shit. You're never going to freak me out with, this person wants to meet. I'm like, hell yeah. Oh, that guy wants to take a picture. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm into it. You know, what's the word? I always, people go, this must be annoying. People want to take pictures. I go, you know what's annoying? If nobody wanted to take my picture.
Yeah. Also, I think there's a thing which is, if you're a big, sturdy guy like you are, if you grew up boxing, if you had a kind of rough and tumble blue collar kind of existence, got a lot of friends, got you in headlocks and shit like that, then like when strangers come up and put their hands around you, put their arm around you or take a picture, or even the drunk guy at the bar, you know, and he's like, come here, man. And he's invading your personal space. You had your personal space invaded so many times, doesn't bump you.
And especially with jiu-jitsu now, when the drunk guy at the club wants to put his arm around me, I'm like, I know exactly how to deflect this, like make it. I could get my arm around him better.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, I know I'm in control of this situation the entire time.
How many dates a year are you doing now?
Oh, shit, a lot. I just did 5 shows last weekend. I got 5 shows this weekend.
Where are they at?
Last week was Oxnard. This weekend coming up is Houston. It's all sold out.
And do you work out much when you're in town, or do you not need to because you're just constantly doing shows?
No, when I'm here, that's when I train as much as I can.
Stand up. I ever said workout. I meant stand up.
Oh yeah, I'm going to do two spots tonight.
Oh really?
I'm going to go do the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory.
How much new material, or do you have a pace where you're like, stand up, I do an hour, I want to do a new hour 2 years later, 3 years later, later?
I'm in the writing process right now. So my writing process is I just get on stage and I figure it out live in front of you. I don't know what I'm going to do or say.
How does it physically manifest itself? Do you record it on your phone? Do you have a slip of paper?
No, I get my assistant to watch me, and then he'll make little notes. You know, you did this a couple of times now, and it worked really well. And then he'll just send me a note saying a word. It'll say vegan, or it'll say cultural dances, or
so
whatever it'll say.
So what we're kind of talking about is you get up there, you kind of get in the moment, and you might turn a phrase on something that you just – didn't anticipate or plan. And it's got an element of that thing of when you have a dream for an invention and then you wake up and you're like, oh, I should have wrote it down, I don't know, I can't remember what it was. And you'll never quite remember exactly what that phrase is.
But also in your dream, that was the best invention you've ever come up with in your life. Right. I've had dreams where I'm like, oh my God, this joke is brilliant. I wake up and I'm like, it kind of sucks. Yeah, it was really good at the moment in my dream, but in real life, it sucked.
Yeah. It's always a disappointment. It's the feeling of it must be the best because I can't remember it, and then so you give it a whole bunch of gravitas. You're like, oh, I'm forgetting the greatest joke ever, the greatest invention ever, and then at some point later in the day, it comes to you, and it's like a 4.5.
Yeah.
But this is interesting because you go up there and have your assistant sit in the audience and observe you, which I think is different than most anyone else. Does that sound right?
Well, I mean,
or did you learn that somewhere?
No, he just started doing it. You know, he'd be, what else is he going to do when I'm on stage? Might as well just watch and especially at this part of the process. Once I come up with the act, he doesn't do it anymore.
Right. Well, I have an assistant, but he sits at home and watch Masked Singer.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do. That's what a good singer does. An assistant does.
So you go and do a set. The set has what worked out in advance? I mean, you have to have some notions of some subjects.
Right now. Okay, so right now I'm a month in.
Mm-hmm.
And understand, on January 2nd when I started, I had zero.
Right.
0 minutes. 0 seconds.
Right.
And now we're a month in. I got 20 minutes already.
Right.
And so he'll just keep watching me, make sure I do that 20 in there, and then build around it.
So you're going to go up tonight. You'll do 20 minutes. It's the 20 minutes you've built since.
Well, it's the 20 minutes I'm working on now. It's still not built.
It's not finished, but it's.
It doesn't even have primer on it yet.
But we can.
It's a lot of Bondo.
It's the we're doing cars.
See what I did for you?
Yeah, I was thinking more home construction, but all right. So
we're not even taping yet.
There you go. We got the sheetrock up, no mud and tape. So you're doing 20, and within that 20, there's going to be some tweaking going on and some refining going on. And your assistant is going to pay attention and figure out which stuff worked or which didn't
work. No, he's just going to be like, hey, you know, you did it this way and it really flowed better. Or you said something different that made it flop. Whatever it is, he'll make a little note for me.
How much of it, you know, you realize you end up thinking a lot about the punchlines, but so much of it is the setup in terms of setting the table for the punchline, like having everyone in the audience know, be on the same page, what you're doing. Sometimes I think I start thinking about the punchline. I kind of rush through the part where you're getting everyone to the punchline. I guess that takes some experience.
Yeah, I mean, you know how to tell a story. It's the same way. Sometimes you get to the punchline of the story, and maybe it just needs something more. It needs another beat to it.
Yeah.
you know, I get to the one, I mean, I'm telling true stories on stage. So sometimes when I get to the meat of it, I'm like, fuck, it's missing something. That's when you have to create another moment in there.
So you'll get it to what length?
I mean, it only goes up to 6 inches, but you're welcome, guys.
You'll get it to an hour.
Yeah, I'll get it to an hour at least.
Right.
I'll just continuously write, so it'll continuously keep building. So by the time, you know, the tour is, let's say the tour starts in June.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the tour gets to June of 2021, that same hour will be about an hour and 20, and it'll be a lot different than the first hour was.
Right. And that'll, when does the process restart?
As soon as you record.
So as soon as you do your album.
As soon as you record the special.
The special.
It's that material dies. It's dead. It's like jizz. Once it hits the air, it's no good to you.
Yeah, although sometimes it gets weaponized. So it, and then off to start the process again.
Yeah, I mean, this is where you're meeting me right now. The process is just a month in.
Do you want to write a movie?
I do want to write a series, but I don't know how to fucking sit down and write. I need a writer who I can sit with and work with, you know?
Oh, look. You know, you figured out putting your assistant in the audience works for you. Definitely, you need a writer. Like, you need someone who can sit at the computer where you sort of pace around or throw the tennis ball against the wall.
Yeah, that's basically what I need.
And you should do that. You should.
Yeah, I've got a lot of ideas. I just don't know how to materialize them.
I can speak from experience that if you have someone who's like, here's what you should find. Find people that are like nuts or whatever it is, whatever you're not. Don't find two of you.
No, I agree. I that's what I would say. The person has to be the complete antithesis of me.
Yeah, you find like nuts and bolts person who's good at typing, good at organizing, good at sort of arranging things. Yeah. And then you get to be this sort of creative spirit and they get to be the sort of vehicle for the creative spirit.
Absolutely.
And
they can also, you know, add to it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
They're going to bring what they bring, and you're going to do what you know how to do.
Were you thinking about a feature or are you thinking about a series?
I'm thinking about a feature. I'm thinking about a series. I'm thinking about a couple of series. There's a bunch of different things in my head.
What your assistant, could you maybe get them
that? He's not that bright. He's not that bright. He can make notes.
Is he here today?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Again, not bright enough to be here.
Just wanted to make... What's his aspirations? He want to be a stand-up?
No. I don't know what he wants to do. You know, he's been with me 10 years. Kid's 38 or 39 now.
Doesn't know what to do.
I don't think he knows what the fuck he wants to do. I don't really know what he wants to do with his life. I mean, as long as he's wants to stay working for me, that works out for me, you know.
Is there I'm always curious for those people that don't know what they want to do or they don't have ideas about what they want to do, but I feel like that's most of humanity, right?
Yeah, we're the lucky ones who kind of figured out a lane of what we're going to do.
Right.
We had a semblance of what – we had an idea of what we wanted to do.
Right.
It's how we manifested it. I mean, you wanted to be a builder. You were a builder.
Yeah, I was.
But then you manifested. You also wanted to be in the entertainment business, so you manifested the building into an entertainment business. And you know what I mean? You've done these things the way you wanted to do them. Ultimately,
yeah, I guess it always feels.
It doesn't feel like the way you thought it was going to be.
Yes,
but if you retrospectively look at it, you go, "Oh shit, that was pretty cool. I guess I did do what I wanted to do."
Well, you know. It depends what mode. I'm constantly in just sort of what's next mode, so I don't do enough sort of looking back and appreciating or understanding what's been accomplished. I just kind of go, what's next?
I'll tell you what's next.
Hmm.
You're going to be the mayor of La Cañada.
The mayor of La Cañada. God, that'd be an awesome job. Where are you living?
Hidden Hills.
So you're kind of doing what a lot of successful people do in Los Angeles, was you're just sort of moving out of Hollywood and raising kids somewhere here.
Yeah, you don't want to be in Hollywood with that.
No, I know. It's.
I just did a movie last summer, and the director lives in – I think he's either next door to you or a house down from you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm. I'm trying to think of who that is.
What the fuck is his name?
Oh, you figure it out. Yeah, there's a group of people. Like, Los Angeles is weird. What people don't really realize is you can't really live. You know, Hollywood's tough. Downtown's tough. You have to kind of move out with the Kardashians somewhere.
I'm literally around the corner from the Kardashians.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's boring, but at a certain stage in life, that's what you want, right?
Yeah.
And you got kids. How many kids do you have?
I have two now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 9-year-old daughter and a 10-month-old son.
How
little? His name's Adam Carolla Peters. I named him after you.
Thank you.
When I do Kimmel, he'll be Jimmy Kimmel Peters. But
do you feel? It's funny. I interview people, and you know, like, my parents weren't good, but they did the best they could. And
my parents are great.
Your parents are great. I feel like my parents did the best they could. But
they did the best they could, and I think that was great.
Do you think your parents did the best they could?
They definitely tried. My dad worked till he was like 70 because he kind of got fucked on a real estate deal
mm-hmm.
that blew his life savings.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he was about 65, that's when he thought he was going to retire.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And then this deal fell apart on him and he lost all his entire, like maybe $250,000 that he had saved.
Right.
And he got swindled out of it. So at like 70, he was running out of money. He just went back to work and worked till he was like 73.
Did he work at like a post office or something like that?
No, not even. He worked in a chicken plant. He was a meat inspector. So he went back to the stinky plant.
Oh, he was an inspector. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Where was that?
In Canada.
I know, but where?
In Brampton, Ontario.
And your mom did what?
My mom worked in Kmart in the cafeteria. And then she ended up working in a high school cafeteria after that. And then she ended up working like in another Kmart type store. It was called Zeller's, and she worked in the Zeller's cafeteria.
So those are real blue collar.
Real deal, buddy.
Real deal jobs. And, you know, I got to say, as a guy who's worked blue collar jobs, construction, building, carpentry, it's like a little monotonous, a little bit tough, and it's a little bit whatever, but you do get some satisfaction with it. Like, you do get to build stuff. Like,
yeah.
You do have a certain sense of pride.
And you need a skill set.
And you do develop a skill set. I feel like working in a cafeteria is just, that's shit on shit.
Oh, it's completely mindless. But my mom did it. She needed to make money. It's fucking minimum wage. It's shit hours.
What do you think is your mom, where would you gauge your parents' intelligence? I know that sounds horrible, but what I mean is it's
my
like.
My dad was highly intelligent.
Right.
My dad was an English major and really well-spoken, an amazing writer.
So why wasn't he? All right, so you're an intelligent guy. I'm an intelligent guy. My parents and your parents didn't really live an intelligent life, I guess you could say, even though they were intelligent.
They were intelligent. My dad is the intelligent one. My mom is not as much. My mom's side of the family is a little
slower, a little more suited for the cafeteria.
My brother and I dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, I got a little of that too. But why wasn't your dad able to find his way out? I mean, I know they got swindled.
No, well, here's the thing. So when my dad moved to Canada in 1965, my dad was a really good writer. So if you were to read anything he wrote, you'd go, wow, who the fuck wrote this? This is really well written.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as far as choice of words and an expanded vocabulary, he was all that. And he had applied for a job for a newspaper in Toronto. They were looking for an editor or a writer or something. So my dad submitted his work, and they liked it. And they see the name Eric Peters, and they're like, great, come on in. And as soon as my dad got there, they saw my dad. He was a short, dark, brown man. And they're like, sorry, sir, the job's filled.
Mm.
And it broke his heart. So he never – he was just like, fuck it. They don't want to give me this job. I'm not going to be able to do what I need to do, but I'm going to need to provide for my family, so I'm just going to work whatever the fuck job I can get.
How much discrimination was there in Canada? Evidently more than we think.
More than you think, yeah. It was, I mean, that was the 60s. I mean,
yeah, I get it.
It wasn't far off from what was happening here as far as that type of stuff goes, but it wasn't as bad as here at the same time.
If your dad would do the exact same scenario here and the exact same date, would it be the same outcome?
It would have been probably the same outcome.
And so your dad was...
It was a sign of the times.
Right. Your dad was discouraged. And
highly. And then when I got into comedy, he was trying to discourage me out of it.
Because your ethnicity?
Yeah, he was like, look, this is not the job for us. Like, he just thought, you know, I was about to be rejected. He was trying to protect my feelings. Because
right.
It happened to him and it hurt him so bad that he didn't want me to feel like that. But, you know, here we are, 31 years later.
Yeah, I try to tell people all the time not to feel like you're a second-class citizen. What I'm saying is that I don't like when everyone preaches the, you know, you got a target on your back because you're black or gay or woman or something.
No.
Because even if you do, it's debilitating.
Well, like, here's the thing. I experienced a lot of racism growing up. Because in Canada in the 70s, especially in the 70s, it started to get a little bit less in the 80s. But in the 70s, the lowest form of human being you could be was an Indian person in Canada.
In Canada.
Yeah, you were really we were really treated shitty. Like,
it was cooler to be black.
Oh, absolutely. But so I would get like – even at – like I'm talking like 5, 6 years old and adults are doing this shit to me, like spitting on you.
Really?
Kicking you, spraying you with a hose. You go to the park, somebody – the older kids throw you into a garbage can. It was just constant.
Right.
But I didn't let it affect me because I was – in my head, it was like, they don't know me. Why are they doing this?
Right.
And that's why I started boxing when I was 15 because I didn't want to get bullied anymore.
Trying to think, you know, living out here, being a little bit older than you and like first impressions. Like when I was growing up, I grew up in Southern California, so it wasn't quite the same as growing up in, you know, the South or something. Black people were like, hey, man, that's Dr. J. You know, like, yeah. There's so many great black athletes that right. It was just awesome. Black kid on your football team was cool, right?
Right.
And
you can't liken us to that, though, because...
No, not at all. I'm saying...
I think our experience would be more like...
Indian was weird when I was growing up. It was sort of like...
The problem was nobody knew anything.
Well, you know what it was? It was about the same relationship we had with your food, which is like... I love Indian food now, but when I was 14, it was like weird food. Like,
yeah, what is that fucking
what is
smell?
That smells
what is
weird?
That color?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Give me a burger. So... You sort of took a while to mature into it. But I always thought of it as I there was a few Indian guys I went to junior high and high school with, and I just thought it was weird. I didn't bother with them. I just didn't have any cultural references. Like there wasn't Indian guys on TV or anything.
Yeah, that was our problem growing up. Like for me, we had like nobody. And that's also why I wanted to get into business because I was like, there's nobody like me on TV. Like I connected to Eric Estrada because he looked Indian as shit.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Punch.
And then when I saw Paul Rodriguez on his sitcom back in the day, I was like, oh, my God. And so I always gravitated to the Hispanic side because they're the ones that look most like us.
Right.
And not understanding, growing up in Canada, there's not a lot of Latinos in Canada, so I didn't even know what they were. I was like,
right.
Whatever they are, they look like me.
Yeah.
And that's how I was like, that's perfect.
So – people, your dad gets discriminated against, and then people are openly hostile to you.
To me, they're openly hostile. To my dad, they were subtle.
Oh, right.
You know what
right.
I mean? But these are kids and stuff like that. It's the 70s, and, you know, I'm a happy kid, and it's just the way it was. I don't look at it as like, wow, these sons of bitches. As you know, it's not the same time anymore. It's not like that anymore. So you can't hold the same foul energy your whole life.
But you didn't internalize all this stuff. I did.
Oh,
you did?
I did, yeah.
But you were saying they don't know you earlier.
In my
on.
Head, I'm saying that. I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
Right.
They would call you Packy. And then you're like, who's the fuck? What is a Packy?
Right.
And then I went home and asked my mom, what the fuck is a Packy? My mom goes, those are people from Pakistan. We're not from Pakistan. We're from India.
Right.
And go tell them you're Indian. I go, I don't think that's going to help.
Right.
I don't think correcting their racism is going to help the situation, Ma. So I'm going to look like a dick.
You did internalize it.
I did. I internalized it. It affected me a lot. And that's why I think to this day, I still talk about race and culture because I'm trying, I guess subconsciously trying to make people understand other people so that other people don't have to go through the same bullshit I went through.
You experienced it a lot. It was sort of, I don't know, people didn't seem to frown on that kind of racism back
then.
Yeah,
no, it was completely acceptable.
Yeah.
What'd you do? Oh, that's fine.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, who was it? Oh, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Who'd you manage to hang out with?
I hung around the black kids.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, nobody bothered them.
Right.
Oh, they didn't bother them as much. And the black kids didn't do it to me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you end up having a lot of black friends in junior high, high
from school? About 4 years old.
Oh, really?
Literally, that's all I hung out with. I was like, fuck, these white kids are fucking mean as shit. I'm going to hang around these black kids.
What did you get from that? I mean, culturally or, you know.
Well, there are a lot of West Indians, a lot of Jamaicans and Trinidadians and Guyanese and stuff like that. So I learned their culture. I knew their culture really well.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up, I always kind of had a bit of an identity crisis because there was no Indian kids around at the time.
Right.
So here I am, this Indian kid, hanging around with a bunch of these black guys. And then my hometown that I grew up in, it's called Brampton, Ontario. In the 70s and in the early 80s, there was very few Indian families there because it was a blue-collar town. It was, you know, white and black, blue-collar. And I graduated high school in 1988, and when I graduated, there was not that many. Maybe about a year or two later, there was this massive influx. And I just did this. I just checked the stats on it. I think the population, it said something about the population was 600,000, and 593,000 of that is Indian.
Really?
Yeah.
What? How did that happen?
I don't know. I guess Brampton is a Native American word for low income housing. I don't know what it is.
So your dad was, I don't know, at the tip of the spear, and I don't know if he even. I don't know what. How did your dad end up there? Parents end up there?
They wanted to buy a house, and it was cheap out there. It was 25 minutes outside of Toronto, northwest. They were like, "Listen, we were living in the city at first," and they were like, "We can't." They didn't own anything in the city. They were renting. My dad was like, "I don't want to fucking rent. I want to buy something."
So, how did you get? You graduate high school.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go after high school?
I thought I was going to go to community college.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the high school I went to was a trade school, they didn't accept the diploma from the trade school as a regular diploma.
What trade did you work on?
I took chef training for 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought I was going to do that.
So why did you go to a trade school?
Because they thought it was slow in the regular school. Remember in the 80s, there was no diagnosis for ADD. It was just like, the kid's a fucking idiot.
Right.
You know, by the end of 10th grade, you should have 16 credits. Right. I had 7.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't even have 1 year's worth yet. And they were like, literally, they pulled, the guidance counselor pulled me in and was like, you're never going to graduate from here.
What do you think, I know my dad grew up in South Philly and went to trade school because you're stupid. Like, they're just like, you don't know anything. You're no good. Learn to play the trumpet in trade school back when that was like a job, playing the trumpet. Could you imagine?
I can't believe Louis Armstrong's your dad. That's amazing.
So He didn't – it was back when they would single people out, but they still singled you out. Did anybody ever pull you aside and say, hey, you're a pretty funny guy or you're a good storyteller or
– My cousin did.
How old were you?
I was about 18. My cousin was like, yo, you're really funny. You should go try doing comedy.
What did that mean to you?
Well, it was the first time somebody had said something like that, like – when he said it, it made sense to me.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't sarcastic. It was really genuine.
Do you feel that was important?
It was a very pivotal moment.
Yeah, you feel that way.
Yeah, definitely. With my cousin Andrew. And then he got murdered right when I found out that I got my first special in 1995.
Really?
Yeah, he got murdered like maybe 2 weeks before.
What happened?
He was living in the Dominican Republic, and it was over some parking spot, and the guy shot him.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And it's so corrupt that the guy who shot him, his family owned a bunch of banks in the Dominican Republic, and the banks were named after the family. So when the guy shot my cousin, his first move was he changed his name legally to another last name, so when it appeared in the newspaper, it wouldn't affect the family.
Right.
And then the cops didn't charge him with murder or arrest him for murder because his family was rich. They charged him for cocaine possession.
And so did he ever do any real time?
None.
Just literally shot him over an argument about a parking space.
Shot him over a parking space, and that was it.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But the importance of that person saying to you, hey, you should be doing this, or you have the ability to do it, because it's not anything you'd heard before that, right?
I'd heard people say, you're very funny, haha, you know.
Yeah,
but when my cousin, because my cousin was not the kind of guy who was none of my family was like overly supportive of anything. Nobody gave anybody fucking random compliments around the
floor. Sure, right.
You know what I mean? We weren't that kind of family. It was not the positive reinforcement family. It was, you know, like it's, you see the kids now, like, that was really good. Oh, wow.
Right.
It was none of that ever. It was never like, wow, that was really good. And it was like, eh.
Right.
And what are you trying to be? Who do you think you are? But my cousin Andrew was like, yo, you're really funny. You should really go to Yuck Yucks and do comedy. And I go, really? He goes, yeah, you should. And I go, are you serious? He goes, yeah, go for it. I think you're going to be good.
It's interesting how free that is. It's kind of like families that never hugged or said I love you or anything. Like, it's all free and yet super short supply with a lot of families. And guidance counselors, people that are supposed to be sort of shaping your life, never pulling you aside and go, okay, look, you're not a great student, but you can turn a phrase, like you can tell a story, like maybe there's something there for you.
No, they didn't do that. It was the 80s.
No, I get it. I had the same thing happen to, or not happen to me.
What did your report card? My report cards always said, almost 100% of my report cards said, Russell is very bright, but fails to apply himself. That's what I always got.
I got just disruptive. I didn't get bright. You know, the thing that was weird, as I recall, people assume that with me, they go, well, you were smart. You just didn't apply yourself. And I was like, nah, I wasn't smart and I didn't apply myself. But it wasn't like there wasn't some swan that was waiting to blossom academically. I was a shitty student.
I was a horrible student.
And I was dumb. Like, yeah. And nobody thought there was any potential.
I would look at other kids and go, oh, how the fuck do you do that? How do you do your homework?
I know.
They sent me to a school that didn't give homework. The trade school, you never got homework. And that's what I loved about it.
Yeah. I remember seeing people just like opening a book, turning the page. Like, yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah. Same. We need a book report. Oh, fuck. You got the wrong guy, buddy.
Yeah, couldn't do it.
I'm not doing a book report. I don't know. What do you want me to tell you? Yeah, I read the book. Tell us about it. What do you want to fuck? I don't want to tell me about the book. I didn't read the goddamn book, all right?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, like, for me, it wasn't like somebody said, hey, man, there's the front yard's covered with leaves. Rake them all up and put them in the trash can. It wasn't like me going, I don't want to do that. It was like handing a monkey an iPhone and going, hit Waze and get me to the improv or something. And the monkey was just like looking at it. Like, I physically couldn't do it. I just would look at people handing in reports and stuff like that. And I just watch them. I didn't know. I couldn't physically do it.
I was very much the same.
So how do you get that into a wildly successful stand-up career? I mean, what did you realize? When I got out of high school, I was like, man, there's a bunch of shit you got to change. Like, you're not good at a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I was not good at anything.
Fix it. Yeah. I did like a self-assessment, and I was like, I gave myself a report card, and it was a shit report card. And I was like, you're going to have to fix a bunch of stuff if you're going to have any success at all.
I always had kind of a hustler mentality, though. It was like, I could figure it out. I could always somehow figure something out. I was like, I'll figure something out.
Was having that learning disability and kind of being at that deficit, that one thing it does get you to do is it gets you to be able to sort of think on your feet, talk your way out of situations, and like have a little of that hustler mentality, right?
Yeah. You need to know how to do that. And I would, I could sell things.
You could.
You know, I worked in shoe stores and stuff. I knew how to sell, and I used to sell fake watches and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
I even had the direct marketing scams done on me where, you look in the newspaper, it's like, make $100 today. And I'm like, all right. And I go, and it's direct marketing where they would just drop you in a fucking industrial area with a hockey bag full of socks, and you had to go sell the socks. And you never got the fucking money. You never got paid. They got paid. You didn't get paid.
People don't realize. I remember going to like Herbalife meetings at people's houses. I remember.
Yeah, it's like Amway or some shit.
I went to Avon. I went to an Amway meeting when I was 29. Like I remember, I was teaching boxing, and I was making like what you know. I'll tell you. So what I was doing is I was doing some building. It was like building cabinets for people and fixing shit on people's houses. I was teaching about 5 boxing classes a week at Bodies in Motion.
What were you charging? $30?
No, I got $20 a class from Bodies in Motion to teach a class. I had a couple of privates, you know, and I had about 3 dudes I do prize for. And they'd like look at me and go, how much for a private? And I'd go, class is $20, so $20, is that okay? And the people was like, oh yeah, it's fine, because they're paying me $20 for a fucking hour-long private boxing. But I wasn't really making any money. And one of the guys who was like a student in my class was like, what if I could guarantee you $300 a week or something? I was like, oh man, yeah, that'd be huge for me if I just got to guarantee that money, because sometimes the construction work's a little hit and miss, you know?
Right.
And the boxing's really, I'm making like $140 a week, but if I could guarantee, he's like, yeah. And I'm like, what is it? And he's like, oh, it's guaranteed. It's easy. Come with me or whatever. And I met him at the Beverly Garland Hotel in like Toluca Lake or something. And I just walked in on a Wednesday night, and I was like, I'm in a fucking Amway meeting.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting there, and they're holding up boxes of soap and shit. I'm like, God damn. Like,
They're chanting and shit like that?
Yeah, and I'm like,
they do the fucking hands in. Yeah, go! $100. Ours was $100 a day is the only way.
And I'm thinking, like, am I going to sell Amway? Am I going to sell detergent and shit? Like,
yep.
I was so... It's when you're rudderless, man, it is the worst. It's the worst ever.
Yeah.
Like having no idea what you're doing. And I think when I see a lot of that income inequality and a lot of this generational poverty and stuff, that's what it is. Like, mm-hmm. I will fucking grab, like, I lived in a house in La Crescenta with 3 dudes in it, and I was like 29, and the other dudes were 29. And my dad never went like, hey, man, what's the plan? You know what I mean? Like, why don't you guys all pool your money, buy a house, live in it, you all pay your rent, it'll be your mortgage, you could fix it up and sell. Like, there wasn't any of that. It was
just... There was no long-term plan. The long-term plan was just don't be fucking unemployed.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's really... Like, you think about your kids, your money is going to help, but your knowledge is going to be much more important.
I remember in 1998, I'd been doing stand-up 9 years already. I'd had 2 specials on TV in Canada, but I had no money at the time. And I remember saying to my dad, it was like a Monday, and I was getting a check on Thursday. And I said, Dad, can I borrow $100? He goes, $100? For what? And I go, just so I can have some money this week. I have a check coming in on Thursday, and I'll give you back your money. He's like, I don't think this comedy thing's working out for you. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Why don't you get a job? I go, what do you mean, why don't I get it? I do comedy. That's at night. Why don't you get a job during the day? I go, where the fuck am I going to work during the day? What, Burger King? He goes, yeah, what's wrong? You're too bloody good for Burger King? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, people go there and make an honest living every day, and you can't go there and earn money? And I go, Dad, I've been on TV a couple of times. People know who I am a little bit now. And I'm going to be, what am I, working at Burger King? And some guys are like, holy shit, Russell Peters, I love your stuff. Can I get the combo too, please?
Yeah, I would come home with like brochures, like be an ambulance driver.
Yeah, just to show you had something.
Yeah, and like
Can you consider the military? You consider everything.
I was like Coast Guard, Reserve, Merchant Marine. Yeah. And no one in my family ever went like, hey, man, look, let's look big picture here. Really think about it. You're a smart guy. Yep. You weren't good at school, but you have other talents. Now let's focus what that could be. Like, it was just like the plan was just get out of the house and go do something.
Yep.
And it's really that. Like, I think people think it's somehow transference of wealth, but it's more than knowledge. It's more what you know that you're going to pass on to your kids.
It's transference of ethic.
Right. Well, it's not even ethic to the extent that your dad worked hard.
No, but they transfer the hard working mentality into you.
Right, and not the smart working mentality into you. And if you talk to people who come from a dad who is an entrepreneur or something, they have a completely different head on things.
Now that's where you get privilege.
Right.
That's where the privilege people say white privilege, but it's not all white people. I mean, I guess all white people to a certain degree, but if you were to break it down financially, no, it's a different – the white privilege for the people that have inherited wealth, they can't relate to guys that didn't have that. Like, they don't understand struggle.
Yeah, I was
– And we respect struggle and appreciate struggle.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did a documentary on the first black driver at Indy. Willie T. Ribbs. It's on Netflix right now, and it's called Uppity. And we're doing like a Q&A, and we're on stage, and Van Lathan's a black man and he's a producer on the film, and he's doing this kind of Q&A with me and Willie T., the driver, and he said to me, he kind of approaches everything from a very black perspective, you know, and he's like, how is it that you could go about as a white person and sort of capture Willie's struggle and being discriminated against and whatnot, trying to drive NASCAR and everything else in the South? And I said, well, I don't know discrimination, but I know struggle. Like, yeah. I've struggled my whole life, so I just tapped into struggle. And he's like, he was kind of saying, yeah, but you haven't figure it's not you haven't been discriminated against, and yeah. I'm like, yeah, but I've struggled a lot.
Struggle,
it's just struggle, right? Yeah. Willie struggled because he was black. I struggled for various other reasons, but I can completely wrap my mind around struggling. That's all we did.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. There's always going to be a common denominator.
Yeah,
yeah. No matter who you're talking to, there will be a common denominator.
Are you glad that you've built up your struggle muscles?
Absolutely. And it's a survival instinct. You know how to survive now.
Right. And
I was poor for much longer than I've had money for.
Yeah, I mean, you're poor from 0 to 35, 36.
36.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the first 35 years I know struggle. This last 15, pretty great. But the first 35, fuck me in the eye, that shit hurt.
But you now have something, a yardstick to measure.
Absolutely.
And
it's all about perspective.
Right. And
I feel bad for my daughter because she won't really understand the other side of it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I used to say to Dr. Drew, and maybe I'll say it to my kids and your kids too, but I meant it with him when he had his triplets. I didn't have kids a long time ago, but I'd go, you know, your kids are going to live in a smaller house than they grew up in. Like, statistically, they're not going to make what you're making.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're not going to afford an $8 million house. Right. You know what I mean? Like, this is going to be the first time sort of in history that your three kids are going to be growing up in a big old house in Pasadena, and they're going to be living in an apartment in Sherman Oaks. Like, yeah. Statistically, I'm not saying
possibly too.
Yeah, they're not going to be on the streets, but I mean, they're going to take regular jobs and be regular people.
I mean,
most likely.
You think so?
I don't
Listen,
know.
Their father's a doctor, and he's a famous doctor.
So
there's
far,
a solid chance that they're not going to live that way.
No, I don't mean they're going to be.
I mean, they're not
going to be destitute.
No. But I mean, What you're proposing is that they're going to live a regular life and get
less,
a regular job.
Less than. What I'm saying is I grew up in 900 square feet North Hollywood, and the house got sold and bulldozed.
Yeah.
I definitely was going to beat my parents.
Like, oh, all I had to do was get a job driving a cab, and I would beat. I'd Same. Live in a better place. You too, right? Same. Right. They may be successful, but they're not going to probably live in a more expensive house than they grew up in.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that they do, but the chances are, yeah, it's stacked against them a little bit.
But here's the interesting thing. They don't care.
You know why?
Because they grew up in it.
Yeah, they're like, that's fine. It's not a goal for them because it's already attained.
Right. You needed to get out.
Yeah, I wanted things. You know what I mean? I wanted plenty of things that I was not getting.
Well, this is a good time to discuss you and I and you being a car guy, which is...
Well, I'm a car purchaser. You're a car guy.
Right. But either way, you got to work to get to get those cars. And there's some people that don't really have hobbies, per se, or loves of that. Like, they go, there's people, they're not really minimalists. They're just like, what do you like doing? I like going to a movie. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, that doesn't cost as much as a Ferrari 599. You just go to a movie.
You buy one?
No. They go to movies. And that's what they do. And they don't, and I always say that wanting cars and having to drive a pickup truck was a lot of what motivated me to do show business. Because I wanted some cool cars, and I knew I had to drive a pickup truck and didn't have any money. Do you feel that way with your career?
Well, yeah, I wanted, you know, it's the same. You still wanted things as a kid, but you can't have the things you wanted as a kid anymore. Now you want adult things, and these are the same adult toys that would be equivalent to what you wanted as a kid.
Yeah, but some people don't have a real interest in that.
I mean, I like new shiny things, you know. I bought the Lamborghini Urus. I love it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But Sarah Silverman doesn't want a Lamborghini Urus.
No, but Sarah Silverman also didn't struggle the same way as us.
I guess so.
You know what I mean? And, you know, to certain people, and more often than not, they just don't want – like a lot of really successful people – And generally, white people don't go for the flashy things. I think it's a non-white mentality.
What's your balance between being motivated to go get some because of how you grew up and the poverty and what you experienced, and then knowing when enough is enough, or when you can kind of back off and enjoy a little bit, like not having that driven?
That's where I'm at now.
That's where you're at now.
That's where I'm at now. Now it's like, now I'm trying to get rid of things. I'm like, I don't need that anymore.
Yeah, because I feel like, I don't know, in a weird way, I feel like people like Madonna are just perpetually miserable because I feel like they're constantly like just grinding. Like, where's the respect? Where I want more? Like, want bigger? Like,
I don't know what she's doing.
I don't know what she's doing either, but I don't feel like there's a lot of happiness. Satisfaction.
She's never exuded happiness, though.
Right, but don't. Isn't the joke on you or Madonna or me, if you grow up in this poverty, then you do get stuff, but you never really stop and smell the roses. You're constantly just churning. You know what I mean?
I very often I sit around my house and I go, this is pretty fucking dope. Like last night I had some friends over at my house, and it was a guy that I've known for about maybe 25 years from Canada. He was in town. And I was showing him around my house, and he was like, this is incredible. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? It fucking is. Because you need somebody else to tell you that, hey, especially somebody who knows your humble beginnings, that sees it and goes, did you ever think? Like, look at this. This is insane. And I'm like, yeah, it is pretty fucking insane.
It's a good exercise. I have it happen with me where people go, I got a guy coming over tomorrow. And he's like, hey, I love cars. I go, come look at my race cars. And he goes, okay. And then at some point, they look at the race cars and they go, oh, man, that was Paul Newman's race car. And that was Paul Newman's race car. And then at some point, they go, thanks a lot, man. I know this is a hassle, but it's awesome. And I go, no. It makes me appreciate it because I'm hearing you appreciate it.
Yeah.
And all I do is walk through it and I kind of forget about it.
Right.
You know what I mean? So get like one of your old friends from the block and come down and walk them through your garage and or your house and have them appreciate it. And then you appreciate it almost through their eyes.
Yeah. Cause you're like, oh yeah, they take you back to who you were.
Right.
And you start to look at it like a visitor. The minute you can look at your life like a visitor is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that's why some people take edibles or drink or whatever. But yeah, do attempt to float outside your life and visit it a little bit.
Yeah.
And it helps you appreciate it. Because when you're in the middle of it, it's really kind of, you know, you like boxing and combat sports and stuff. And sitting and watching a fight is super entertaining. And then being in a fight is not entertaining. And
right.
You should be sitting front row and watching yourself fight a little bit rather than sort of adrenaline dump.
Yeah.
You know, standing and just squaring off fight or flight.
Yeah, you gotta stop and have a look at it. That's the only way to appreciate it.
That's a good note to go out on. Let me give you some plugs. Russell Peters, Deported. I'm going to watch it as soon as I get home. It's available now on Amazon Prime Video. And also Vegas coming up at the Encore Theater at the Wynn Hotel. Two shows, June 6th. Tickets on sale Friday. Go to WynnLasVegas.com. And the website, Russell Peters, just how you'd expect it to be spelled, RussellPeters.com. And at Twitter, at the Russell Peters.
The real
at
Russell.
The real Russell P. Yes?
And Instagram is just Russell Peters.
Thanks, man. It's always good,
Adam,
to see you.
You too.
I hope I see you at the Comedy Store soon.
I'll be around. How's Jimmy doing?
Jimmy's doing well. I'm going to go see him tomorrow night. He's doing a thing with Huey Lewis. I think he's like interviewing Huey Lewis something at some center, and I'm going to go out and we'll hang out.
You know what's funny is I was at Eddie Murphy's house that night that Jimmy was there, and he mentioned it on the air, but he didn't mention me, and I was like, fucker.
Oh, I didn't even know. Oh, he went to Eddie Murphy's house.
Last year. It was insane. Like, everybody was there. I mean, I could see why you didn't mention me, but I would like to have been mentioned. I'd like to be remembered that I was there.
I'll tell him that Russell is butthurt and that he needs to fix it pronto.
Tell him I'm really, really, I'm all in my feelings.
I will tell you and tell him, and we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with the news right after this.
Adam Carolla is unprepared all winter long.
Well, Kimmel, Dad, Adam, again on stage in free ball. Totally unprepared with no material at all. He's gonna go.
He's gonna go.
He doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
What the hell he's gonna say until you tell him so.
He's gonna go.
He's gonna go.
He doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
Until you give him an idea.
Written out a ball. Get your tickets for the show. What word awaits? He's gonna go.
He's gonna go.
Don't miss Adam Carolla is Unprepared. Aces in Cleveland, Ohio at Hilarities on February 27th and Indianapolis at Helium on February 28th and 29th. And at Helium in St. Louis on April 10th and 11th. Get prepared for Adam Carolla is Unprepared by getting your tickets now at adamcarolla.com.